My drops.
Adam?
Yes. Eddie, I'm not sure what these sections in black are about, but they're not obviously legible. They want to take it out for a reason, but otherwise
they need
change the formatting.
Can I give you a call on the other side, on the landline?
Adam.
Okay, sure.
Adam?
Yes, sir.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine, and you?
Good, good, good. Those blacked out sections are not necessarily for Home Affairs. They are basically for the Portfolio Committee. So we decided to black them out rather than leave the spaces, you know, as blank as if it's not fully completed. So we were just completing what was relevant to the department.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that.
Yes. Yes. So, yeah.
Coming. Yes. Chairperson?
Yes, Eddie.
Yes, it's 9 o'clock now, and we do have enough members to start the meeting and also to have a quorum to make a decision if we have to make a decision somewhere. So we can start the meeting now. Adam, if you can put up the agenda on the screen.
Thank you very much, Eddie and Adams. Good morning, members. Good morning to, I've not seen the minister, if he's present, good morning to the minister. I've seen the deputy minister. Good morning, Shazo. And morning to the chairperson of IEC, Mr. Mashini.
Morning, good morning, Chair.
I saw Ms. Love.
Morning, Chair.
And I've seen Mr. Shibori. I've not seen the CEO. Morning to you, the leadership of the IC.
Morning, Chair.
We are having an agenda item that is beamed, members. And welcome back, Honorable Ross. I'm told you were writing exams. We always, as Pedelang, when we're not in the meeting.
Thank you, Chair.
So the agenda is as beamed, members. We have visitors today. On item 4, we're going to get a briefing from United Nations and the lawyers for human rights. I'm told there is Mr. Zulu. Mr. Zulu and the other colleagues will introduce themselves as they do the presentation, because I take note that some members may not be knowing them, but we have called this meeting today as well as routine meetings that we normally have, but we have requested IEC to come. It was informed by the fact that we in the National Assembly had already passed a bill which relates to the upcoming elections. And such a bill was debated and later taken to the National Council of Provinces for the purposes that is required by our constitution when we enact any law or legislation. And we were advised that the NCOP, in its wisdom, has introduced some of the changes. And the bill is back to the National Assembly for us to consider as a committee those changes that were effected at that level. So we've requested the IC to come and give us a briefing, which briefing will be followed by a meeting that I called for Friday, urgent meeting for Friday, to consider the B and the C list, so that we don't drag the matter further as the committee. So we have requested the IEC to come. So the first briefing will be done by the IEC. And then after that, we'll take the comments and questions on that specific aspect. And we have strictly 15 minutes. After that, you can remain in the meeting, Chairperson Mashini. Because we just want to be part of a meeting as part of a public participation process. But if you have other pressing issues, you can be excused after that briefing. Then we'll proceed with the agenda as it is beamed until we come to an end. I am members envisaging that it will not be a long meeting, but we've been allocated 3 hours to deal with these agenda items. Suffice to say that the IEC item will be followed by a Friday meeting where we're looking at the B and the C list, so that we present it to the House before the House rise up. We're meeting again today Just when you all know that this is a month of the human rights are one important things that are embedded in the Constitution of the Republic. I think Section 2 of the Constitution is dedicated entirely on what we call human rights, fundamental rights, which we have spent as a country, I'm sure, over 82 years fighting to get these rights. And we're also meeting, celebrating our women internationally. I think this is part of the commitment that we have made as a country, that we wanted to create a society that is a non-racial, non-sexist, democratic, united and prosperous. So we will be celebrating the human rights alongside women the entire month of March, in making sure that we truly achieve a non-sexist society. I think with that, Eddie, do we have some apologies?
Yes, Chairperson, I've got three apologies. One from Ms. Tito, who's still on maternity leave. Then the next one is Ms. Hanyile. She didn't indicate the reason, but she just said she's not able to attend the meeting. Then the last one is the late arrival of joining the meeting. Ms. Mulekwa said she's attending a funeral, so she will be joining us at 10 o'clock. That's all, Chairperson.
All right. I take it, members, that the apologies are accepted.
Chairperson?
Yes.
Chairperson? Apologies.
I'm recognizing Minister.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, may I ask to attend the NCC at 11 o'clock. I've missed many NCCs because they clash with portfolio committees. And today there's an item that really will need my attention. So can I leave at 11? I'll leave the Deputy Minister and the DG.
Okay. Honorable Chaban?
I want to submit an apology of bereavement. Honorable Okupase, she wasn't able to attend the committee meeting. Mother has passed away. And Honorable Mudise also was not able to attend the meeting. The aunt passed away yesterday. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much for those apologies. Minister, you leave us in the capable hands of the DM and the DG. I think we are quite amenable with that. Can we now proceed to the item? And I want to hand over to you. But before I hand over to you, Minister, I don't know, do you want to make some remarks on this process before I hand over to the IEC?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Chairperson of the IEC. Thank you very much, really, for giving me this opportunity. I only have one remark, and I think you have already remarked about it. I just want to emphasize it, that whatever happens, this issue needs to be finalized before the parliament tries to go on recess. Because if it's finalized and it's not finalized and we went for parliament to go on recess, we'll be in very, very dangerous grounds in terms of preparations for the local government election. So I'm just begging the committee that let's try by all means that parliament deals with this matter before it rises. That's all I need to say, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. Chairperson Mashini and the team, I'm now handing over to you.
Chairperson.
Honorable Likot.
Sir, I'm just asking to be accepted in the meeting. I'm here, but I'm struggling to get in, but I think I can hear everything that's going on.
But you are in, veteran.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Wanted to be in two times.
Okay, thank you. Over to you, Honorable Bashir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair of the Portfolio Committee, Advocate Pongo. The Honorable Minister of Home Affairs, Dr. Mzwaledi, as well as the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs, Mr. Nzuza, together with the DG and Senior DG Makonde from Home Affairs and senior officials present. Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, thank you for the opportunity to once again to appear before this honorable committee and to engage on the Electoral Laws Amendment Bill as per the invitation. In the interest of time, I will dispense of my lengthy salutations. Safe to say, I am accompanied by my fellow commissioners, as well as the CEO, together with the Deputy CEO, Mr. Shiburi, who would be making the presentation, and other senior officials from the IEC. Briefly, honorable members, the National Assembly, yes, passed the Electoral Laws Amendment Bill last year following the approval of the bill in this committee. And on behalf of the Commission, we wish to thank the committee for leading this process and for your assistance in getting the bill approved as a matter of urgency. Today, we return to actually share, as per the invitation of the chair, the issues that are under reconsideration in the bill. For us as the Commission, what we can say, this really is marks this the importance and the strength of our democracy. And where we are is that we did receive the submissions when the bill moved to the National Council of Provinces. And among those inputs, the Commission decided that those would enhance in the drafting. And so in consultation with the information regulator, the commission and the parliamentary legal teams then proceeded to redraft two sections, which my colleague would actually explain in detail, section 16 and section 47. And these revisions were then subsequently approved by the Select Committee and the National Council of Provinces. And now they are being resubmitted to this auspicious committee. And allow me then to invite invite Mr. Shiburi, who would shop these changes. All I can just say about that is that the process itself sought to find the balance to the protection of personal information on the one hand and the right to freedom of expression on the other hand. And so the inputs we then received also from the members of the public, the civil society, as well as the Honorable Minister of Home Affairs and other members of Parliament. So we hope that this would be acceptable to the members. There aren't any fundamental changes to what we had approved, but this just sought to accommodate the other parties in a much more progressive way. On behalf of the Commission, let me humbly request that the members consider it as already the Honorable Minister has indicated that we are faced with a time factor. The challenge for us is that we need this to be approved as of yesterday.
and we hope then the honorable members will find this appropriate and accommodate in time. Let me then, through you, Chairperson, invite the Deputy CEO, Mr. Shibori, who to take us through the details of what is a proposed amendment. Thank you, honorable members, and thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. The input is limited only to instances of divergence between the version of the bill approved by the NCOP and that adopted by the National Assembly. It is worth noting that the bill has a total of 23 clauses, and in the majority of cases, 21 clauses. The Select Committee and the Portfolio Committee coalesce, they are in agreement. The two clauses on which there are divergence are clauses 14 and clauses 20, and I will deal with them in turn. Even where there is divergence, it is a submission that the views are not mutually destructive and that common ground can be found. As I said, the clauses that are implicated are clauses 14 and clauses 20, and we will project those now for ease of reference. And I start with what is already now on your screen, clause 14, which implicates section 16 of the Electoral Act. Section 16 of the Electoral Act is concerned with the publication of the voter's roll. The version on the screen is a version that was passed by the Portfolio Committee and adopted by the National Assembly. The key thing in the version that was approved by the Portfolio Committee are as follows. The Portfolio Committee had sought to delete Section 16.2. Section 16.2 provides that the Chief Electoral Officer must provide a certified copy of or extract from a segment of the voter's roll as it exists at that time to any person who has paid the prescribed fee. In other words, the section provided in very peremptory terms and forced the CEO to release a segment or a copy of the voter's roll. No purpose ought to be advanced for access to the voter's roll. The only limitation was that the person must have provided or must have paid the prescribed fee. This unfettered access to the voter's roll and for no election purposes and the consequential access of voters' personal details was the preeminent reason why the committee sought the deletion of section 16.2. The other sections here are very minor changes on which the two committees have agreed. I wish that we go now to section 16.5. No, still on the first page. Thank you. That one at the bottom is. Thank you. The second amendment in clause 14, section 16, was the introduction of section 16.5, which seeks to compel the chief electoral officer to redact information on the voter's roll provided in terms of section 16.3. This is done to protect the personal information of voters and guarantee the constitutionally enshrined rights to privacy. As the chairperson has indicated, following the adoption by the National Assembly of this version of the bill was referred to the NCOP. During the consideration of the NCOP, there were a number of submissions that were received by that committee, by the Select Committee of the NCOP, and which were considered by the Electoral Commission. In those circumstances, the Select Committee and the NCOP redrafted Section 16 in a manner that seeks to strike a balance between facilitating access to the voter's roll while at the same time safeguarding the voter's personal information. And in order to contextualize the redraft, I think it is necessary that I take 2 minutes to go through the submission so that we could understand why the NCOP redrafted the bill in the manner that it did. There were two categories of submissions that implicated Section 16. The first class of those submissions argued that deleting Section 16(2) would have the effect that access to the voter's roll would only be limited to parties and independent candidates, and that for the rest of other persons who have an interest in accessing the voter's roll, access would only be by way of physical inspection at the place designated by the Electoral Commission or via a laborious promotion to access to information application. In terms of the argument, this limitation would hamper the media and civil society actors to access the voters' role and would impede these groups from performing their watchdog role in relation to elections. And in the final analysis, that such limitation to access to information by limiting it to physical inspection could offend the requirements of meaningful access. The second argument related still to Section 16 was that the authority to redact voters' personal information in Section 16(5) could undermine the right and ability of parties and independent candidates to check the accuracy of the voter's roll and its credibility. Secondly, that the discretion vested in the CEO to redact information was not determined, and in any case, it would have been overly broad and open to abuse. The submission do not support reduction because they think it is critical that the voter's roll must be provided with the full names of voters, the full identity number of a voter, as well as an address. So those are the submissions received by the NCOP. Having considered those and having taken counsel, the Commission arrived at the conclusion that, one, there is no legal defensible basis to withhold the provision of copies of the voter's roll, and that if we had persisted with the deletion of Section 16(2), that bill would be unlawful for lack of making provision for access to information. The Commission in the circumstances concluded that it will make the copies of the voter's roll available, but that will be subject to the requirements for the lawful processing of personal information as stipulated in the Protection of Personal Information Act or POPIA. And the salient aspects of POPIA are as follows. POPIA requires that information must be provided in a lawful manner. In other words, personal information must be processed lawfully and in a reasonable manner that does not infringe the privacy of voters. Secondly, it enshrines the principle of minimality in that only information that is adequate for a purpose must be processed. It follows, therefore, that if you release relevant information, that should be sufficient, and therefore the information that's disclosed should not be excessive. Thirdly, that there must be lawful justification. In other words, processing must comply with an obligation and public law duty. There is no doubt that the Constitution, the Commission, and the electoral and the Chief Electoral Officer are under a lawful duty to provide copies of the voter's roll. From the foregoing, it is evident that the Commission had to furnish the voter's roll, but in so doing, it had to ensure that, one, the voter's roll is provided only for explicit and specifically defined lawful purposes. Two, that it should impose a penalty for the use of information received received under Section 16.2. Now that you've sketched the challenges and the obligations of the Electoral Commission, we now deal with how the shortcomings in the original Section 16 are ameliorated. And on the screen is the redrafted Section 16 as adopted by the NCOP. In this version, Section 16.2 is reinstated. Remember, the Portfolio Committee version and National Assembly version was to remove Section 16.2. In the version approved by the NCOP, Section 16.2 is reinstated, but it is redrafted in a manner that it strikes a balance between the right to privacy, i.e. not disclosing information of voters unnecessarily, and two, guaranteeing access by interested parties. It achieves this balance by making it clear that access to the voter's roll is no longer absolute, so it cannot be any person who has access to the voter's roll. Access, if this version is accepted, must be linked to a prescribed purpose, and that purpose is set out in the new 16.2a, and there are three broad purposes. The first is that the person must aver that they require a copy of the voter's roll in order to monitor election, or they require it for statistical research or scholarly purposes. Three, that they require it for a purpose that is already prescribed in law or in the Constitution. And in B, we are introducing, we are making it clear that the information, even requested under this new section, must still be subject to the provisions of POPIA, in that it must provide minimal information, it must be information that is lawfully and related to a legitimate legal purpose. Lastly, we introduce Section 2A, which makes it an offense for anyone to use the information that they've obtained under Section 2A for purposes other than monitoring the voter's roll, for purpose other than statistical research or scholarly purpose, or any purpose that is prescribed in the law. So we retaining Section 16.2, but we're linking it to a purpose so that we limit the class of persons who can get access to the voter's roll. The change in Section 16.3 is technical. It just references the properly referenced phrasing, and here there's agreement between the Portfolio Committee and the Select Committee. The last clause under Section 16 is Section 16.5 towards the bottom of the page. There. The view of the Electoral Commission is that it is necessary and lawful to redact information or to redact certain digits of the voter's identity number in order to preserve the privacy rights of citizens and voters. In other words, we do not agree that the voter's roll made available in terms of Section 16 must contain the full ID, the full name, and the address of the voter. We will provide the voter's roll with the full names. It will contain the address where we have an address. However, the Parliament, if this bill is passed, would make it clear that certain digits of the voter's roll would be redacted so that we preserve the privacy rights of the voters. You'll recall that second attack to Section 15 was that Section 16.5 was that it vested discretion in the person of the Chief Electoral Officer to determine on the manner of reduction, and that that could lead to abuse of that power. We're making it clear that Parliament will be responsible for determining the manner of the reduction so that we limit the perception that the powers vested in the Electoral Commission goes overboard and the discretion is unfettered. There is a new nuance which is provided in B. So the scheme is that the voter's roll that is made available in terms of Section 16 would have certain digits of the ID numbers redacted, in other words, not disclosed. However, there may be instances where it is unavoidable for more digits of the ID number to be disclosed. A classic example is, let's use the CEO's example, in the village in Munyaning, Eha Mamabolo, you may have six or more Simon Mamabolos on that segment of the voter's roll born on the same date. So if you provide only the six key digits, you can't tell one Simon Mamabolo from the other Simon Mamabolo if they also share names. In those limited cases, it may be necessary that we provide additional digits so that if you want to object against that person's being on the voter's roll, you can distinguish between those entries on the segment of the voter's roll. The last clause, Chair, which is impacted by the amendment at the instance of the NCOP, is in clause 20, section 47, which is related to the Municipal Electoral Act. Again, the version approved by the Portfolio Committee is on the screen, followed by the version approved by the Select Committee. During the public participation process, submissions had argued that in its original draft, the amendment amounted to impermissible delegation of legislative powers, in that the manner of a valid voting method is not determined by the legislature, but rather left to the commission. By way of background, this section is concerned with safeguarding the continued franchise of those South Africans who are registered as voters, but for whom the Electoral Commission still does not have an address. We're making it abundantly clear that those countrymen and countrywomen are still entitled to vote, not because they have an address, but they're entitled to vote because they are citizens and they are guaranteed political rights. So, but before they vote, they should supply their address or a description of the place of ordinary residence, which address and or place of ordinary residence must locate within the boundaries of the ward in which they wish to participate. The Commission has agreed to the submissions and proposed a drafting which has been accepted by the NCOP. In this draft, the draft makes it clear that the different voting method in Section 47.7 is still subject to the requirements and safeguards contained in Section 47. In other words, the voting method is still subject to what already obtains in the law under Section 47, in that a voter must first be registered as a voter on that segment of the voter's roll. They must present their identity document. They must present themselves at the station at which they are registered. They must have their names marked off the voter's roll. Their thumb must be marked with indelible ink to indicate that they have voted in that election. By way of summary and in conclusion, we have sought, Chair, to strike a delicate balance between two core rights. The first being the right to access to information, which right cannot be unduly limited in an open and democratic society, as well as the other competing right, which is the privacy rights guaranteed by the Constitution. So in the final analysis, instead of deleting Section 16.2, it is retained in a manner that removes unfettered access. In other words, no person can just ask for a voter's roll because they've paid a prescribed fee. There must be a purpose, and that purpose must accord to the law in terms of the new drafting in Section 16.2, which is they want it for election purposes or scholarly or research purposes, and they want it because it is provided for in the law or in the constitution. So there is explicitly defined purpose to access to a voter's roll. The second introduction is that we're linking that access to the voter's roll, and we're linking it to an offense to say, if you receive the voter's roll for these purposes and you use it for purposes other than those limited purposes, that person is guilty of an offense and will be liable to a fine or imprisonment. The third point, the Commission feels very strongly that the reduction of the voter's ID, some digits of the voter's ID number in Section 16.5 must be maintained to protect the voter's personal information. This clause has, however, been redrafted to make it explicit the nature of the reduction, and that we do not transfer that power to the Electoral Commission. So that reduction is at the instance of Parliament and not at the instance of the Electoral Commission. And the manner of the reduction is made clear in Section 16.5. The last change that we dealt with, Chair, was in Clause 20, which relates to Section 47 of the Municipal Electoral Act. Here, we have redrafted the section to make it clear that the different voting method is still subject to the prescription that Parliament had determined in Section 47 of the Municipal Electoral Act. That deals, Chair, with the two broad areas in which there are divergence between the version approved by the NCOP and that approved by the National Council of by the NCOP and the National Assembly, and to indicate that of the 23 clauses, the two committees and the two houses are agreed on 21 clauses, but these two clauses that are still outstanding, we still think that the two houses are not too far apart, and that the versions are not mutually destructive, and that an accommodation could be found that walks the tightrope between access to information while guaranteeing the freedom to access and privacy to citizens.
Thank you, Chairperson. That is the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair of the IC, and thanks for the presentation, Mr. Chiburi. Members, here is the presentation. Can I note the hands? I'm going to Honorable Pile, number one, number two, Honorable Ross, number two, Honorable Lekota, number three, Honorable Lekota, number four, Honorable Mkina, number five, Honorable Lizelle, number six, Honorable Chavana, in that order.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation made, and to say that one of the very important points that we made as a committee was the withholding of ID numbers, particularly to protect the rights and the identity of voters. And I think it's important to note that that has been taken. So we support that, and I hope that we can now finalize this matter on Friday. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Ross.
Thank you, Chair. And firstly, allow me on behalf of the Democratic Alliance to express our condolences to Honorable Lekwase and to Honorable Madise. But Chairperson, I'm going to be talking about this Section 5, so Item 8, the amendment to Section 16. So what the section says is, it says the chief electoral officer must redact any information appearing on the voter's roll provided to a registered party or independent candidate in terms of subsection 3 as may be necessary for the protection of personal information of voters against unreasonable disclosure. So the example has been given of these multiple Siamama Mabulos. And now we're saying that first of all, you must go and find some anomaly or based on the information that you have. And in that case, if you find that anomaly, then you can ask for the rest of the information. So the challenge comes is if you need the rest of the information to find the anomaly before you can ask the question. So, for example, we had the issue of multiple voters. Now, how would you detect duplicate ID numbers, for example? Let me give you a simple example. It would be impossible. Let's say there were Sai Mamabolo and there was John Mamabolo who had got a copy of that ID and not knowing.
Honorable Ross, I'm losing you. Honorable Ross.
There were two different.
Honorable Ross. Honorable Ross. Eddie.
Yes.
I've lost Ross. Can you talk to him? We're going to pass him and then you come back.
Oh, okay. Maybe if you can ask other members whose videos are on, maybe to see that they are not speaking, they can switch them off.
Honorable Ross, are you back?
Just continue, I'll give him a call.
Honorable Likota? Honorable Ross, I see you're back, but there's a problem with your network.
Yeah, sure. It's very strange it cut out at that specific time.
But I want to just get your network proper because a lot of the things that you have said could not get through. So you'll have to almost start afresh. But after, let me take Mkhina. After Mkhina, maybe the network will be better off.
Thank you.
Honorable Mkhina Chwap.
No, thanks, Chair. Myself, I'm having problems with the network. It kicked me in back, forth, and all of that. So I hope that things will be fine. No, thank you very much, Chair. I just wanted to ask maybe a couple of, one or two questions, the questions for clarity. So this bill, does it mean that now the information, my information, before it's given to the other third party, they are going to take away my ID and my location, like my address. Is this what this bill is actually saying now? And then also I wanted to ask, how will the IEC ensure that an institution or individual who is asking for a voter's roll is not going to use that information for rogue activities. As we know that the leader of the EFF, they've compromised his the security and located his address, and they pinned it all over the news for any criminals to know where is his house is. So I would like to know from the IEC, if myself I'm going to ask for a voter's roll, and they grant it to me. How will they monitor that very, very closely? Because it's very, very sensitive information that that they will actually gonna be taking out. Because it also says that as determined by the chief electoral officer, you know, that individual will be granted access to that voter's roll. What will the chief electoral officer use as the basis of saying that he's going to give that individual the full disclosure, everything, ID and addresses to that individual who actually wants it? So that those are actually my concerns and my key. And then, I mean, when would you know that when Mgrini is asking for this voter's roll, he's going to use it for research and all of that? So that's where this gray area is. And because I thought the reason why we some of the this bill was reviewed is to protect our information. So I wanted to check now, if you are zooming in into this issue, how would you do that? How would you make sure that the information is protected and there's a proper accountable oversight? There's an oversight in terms of whoever has been given this is not going to use my information for rogue activities. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Ross.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. Chair, Section 5, so if you look at Item 8, the amendment to Section 16, subsection 5 over there, it talks about unreasonable disclosure. This is what we're talking about when we talk about redaction and access to personal information. Now, the example of a Saima Mabolo was given of multiple Saima Mabolos in a village. And in this case, you have the information that you need to pick up that something is wrong. And then you can go and ask for the rest of the information. However, what if the information that you need to pick up if something is wrong is in the information that is hidden? Then you will not be able to ask for the other information. So, for example, we had issues with duplicate voting. But what if you had the duplicate ID numbers on the voter's roll? So somebody had somehow got a copy of an ID and managed to somehow have a John Mamabolo that had the same ID number as somebody else. How would you pick that up? It would not be possible. I'm not sure of all the possible examples, but I think the key focus here is the unreasonable disclosure, because we have clauses that talk about what happens if that information is used for an incorrect purpose. So that is provided for both in this legislation and the POPI Act. But now we say we want to protect privacy. What we are giving to the parties at the moment is the full name of the person, most of the ID number, which is enough information to tell how old you are, for example, and the address of where you live. So the only information that is being hidden here is, let's say, your gender. And even that, you know, the protection of gender, for example, that's part of the identity and policy now, is how are we going to change that so that we don't have a gender marker in our IDs? And so if we're saying that the whole purpose of the redaction is to stop your gender from being revealed, then one wonders, well, why must the address be given? Why must the name be given, et cetera, et cetera? It's about the purpose. So if we talk about the interpretation of statutes, for example, it's a critical part of law because it stops us from reading sections of law in isolation and just saying, okay, I read this section and I interpret it this way. That's why you have a preamble to every legislation. So if we look at the preamble of the Protection of Personal Information Act, it talks about what it serves to protect. And then it also says consonant. So consonant with the constitutional values of democracy and openness, which means to match or to exist with. In other words, the restrictions must be taken in the context of the need or the constitutional values for democracy and openness. So we can't just consider the one side where we say that certain information needs to be protected from unlawful use. We also need to bear in mind that democracy and openness needs to be protected. And this is specifically stated in the POPI Act. And then it goes on to say that anything that requires the removal of unnecessary impediments to the free flow of information should not be allowed. And that is what is happening in this case. We are taking away certain elements of an ID number, for example, that puts impediments in the way of fully understanding if there are any problems with this voter's roll when we look and interpret it. If we look at Section 3B of the POPI Act, it says that this act must be interpreted in a manner that does not prevent any public or private body from exercising or performing its powers, duties, or functions within the terms of the law. So here we are saying that the political parties and independent candidates need to get this data to perform a specific oversight role and to ensure that that the democracy and openness take place. And so, you know, we as the Democratic Alliance, we absolutely agree. Let's say on the IEC website, you shouldn't just be able to type in a name or something and get somebody's ID number and details. Absolutely. So that information should be redacted on that site. You should only as yourself as an individual be able to type in your own ID number and then potentially see if you're registered or not. So that we fully agree with. You know, for the general public, they shouldn't be able to necessarily see all that information, or a mechanism needs to be in place to say, you as an individual can see all your information, absolutely. But we already have Clause 4 here, where it talks about, you know, what will happen if political parties and independent candidates use this information or misuse it or make it public. And so that Clause 4 is serving that purpose in terms of, you know, security breaches, thefts, people getting this data and using it for commercial purposes. And so, Chair, you know, the Section 5, it really needs to be removed. It is going against the purposes of the POPI Act. If we really look at that, and I've quoted you the clauses. And then if any political party uses it for commercial gain, if there's a security breach, then they need to be held to account like anybody else. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable, listen. Thank you, Ross.
Yeah, sorry, Chair. I've also got some connection issues. Thank you very much to the IEC and to Chairperson Mashlinge and the rest of the IEC team. I think it's quite concerning for me that we only now realizing that the version of the bill that we sent to the NCOP was in fact unlawful. And that's concerning because the very issues that we are dealing with now are the very issues that we raised when we did the clause by clause deliberations. I think we did at that point, of course, had some disagreements as a committee, but you know, it would have been prudent of us had we considered those issues when we were doing these clause by clause deliberations, because now again we are rushed for time, the bullets come back from the NCOP, and we could have done justice to this issue at the start. And you will recall that, Chairperson, at the start we did indicate to you that some of us felt that the process was rushed. But that being said, I think some of the changes that are being proposed now are in our best interest. Of course, I will consult my caucus before Thursday. But of course, also I do share the concerns that the two previous colleagues have raised. When it comes to now saying, of course, we welcome the fact that the voters' roll will now be in some instances be made available to members of the media and civil society for them to be able to play the oversight role. So as the IFP, we welcome that, because it's something that we wanted from the start. But also when we speak about the element of monitoring and the fine element, you know, like the Honourable Mgrini said, how possible or how feasible will it be for the IEC to monitor that? Because I imagine by the time that somebody has already abused my personal details for commercial gain or for other unlawful activities, it will be too late to undo that, to find the person, to find that person. So it might be a bit of an administrative nightmare. And then I also share some of the concerns that Honourable Ruth raised with regard to the reduction of the ID numbers. But as I said, we are largely in support of the changes that have been proposed. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Coach. Honourable Chabani.
No, thank you, Chair. Thanks very much, Chair. I think also want to welcome the brief report from the IEC informed by the process that was also engaged in the NCOP. And I think, Chair, it is not it is incorrect to suggest that we have passed the unlawful bill at the ENSO, at NA. And I think if we listen carefully to the IEC presentation, they do indicate that there are areas, in fact, most areas where the NA and the NSOP coheres in terms of the clauses that we've passed through. So I wanted just to, because the two houses have a responsibility, Chair, to look on the process that we're engaged on in terms of processing the legislation. And we have thoroughly engaged on this process as the committee, noting that appreciation in the process of engagement, different view do emerge, but might not be conclusively being suggested that the NA has a passed unlawful act on the basis of a different view I hold to the process that was engaged. I wanted just to also raise that. And say, I think it's important that we do appreciate and welcome the work that has been done by the NSOP, though that we still have to engage, as we've indicated on Friday, on the final details and how we consolidate our thoughts to adopt on the issues that are raised by the IEC. Two issues, Chair, which I wanted to also raise as a submission and to sort clarity from the IEC. One is on the issue that has been canvassed on the safeguard of the voters' role. And I think for the usage of this information, as I think has been outlined, that others, they want to use it for fraudulent activities against our citizens. Because in a country we deal with some non-citizens, some temporarily, some are illegal. I think all of us we were aware to that reality. What are the mechanisms that if Honorable Ruos and Honorable Chabani seek information at the IEC, which is legitimate, but they are non-citizen of the Republic, what are the mechanisms in place to, because obviously they will use it either for a wrong reason, but one just to establish what are the mechanisms in place that they, in terms of the clause, that is exposed to this negative reality that will impact on the work of the IEC. Secondly, Chair, obviously, I wanted to check with the IEC if there's an exemption. You know the historical demographics of our country, of those that can have payment fees to access the voters' roll as has been outlined, and we have legitimate reason to access the voters' roll. What are the areas of concession to assist some of the people who are poor? They can have resources even to meet the requirements in terms of the financial obligation to access the voters' roll. I concur with the area that the Honourable has raised already of the ID reduction. I think it find expression to what it has already been engaged in the process of this information. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Chabani. Honorable, not Honorable Chairperson Machine.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the Honorable Members. I think in the interest of time, let me invite the CEO to respond to the issues and then allow that other members of the commission who are present, they can also add any clarity that might be required. Thank you, Chair. CEO.
Good morning, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, members of the committee, Chairperson, Minister, Deputy Minister, and the Commissioners and colleagues in Home Affairs. Chairperson, the issue of Section 16.5 is an important issue which has enjoyed substantial consideration at the level of council, as well as in the select committee. It is not a matter that we are placing before this committee lightly. It's a matter upon which we've had significant consideration. But I think it's important that we contextualize the whole of 16. You see, and what the purpose of 16 overall is in relation to the overall constitutional scheme. Because that section 16 does not sit in the Electoral Act for the sake of it. That section 16 is inextricably linked with section 19 of the Constitution. And section 19 in part provides that every citizen, not adult citizen, but every citizen is entitled to free, fair, and regular elections. Now, in order to vindicate that right for free and fair and regular elections, you must be enabled to check whether the voter's role is correct, which is why in the new section 16.2, part of the purposes that are clarified for requiring a voter's role is that to monitor the elections. Because why do you need to monitor the elections? Because you want to vindicate your section 19 right to a free and fair elections. Understanding, of course, that the free and fair elections rests on a voter's role which is free of irregularities. Amongst others, a free and fair election rests on a voter's role which is free of irregularities. Now, Section 10 of BOPEA, and this is a point that Shiburu had clarified, provides a principle of minimality. Now, what does that mean? Minimality means you provide information that is necessary to a purpose. In other words, you provide as much as is necessary in order to satisfy a purpose. Now, the Constitution says two things about qualification to be on the voter's roll. Firstly, you've got to be a South African citizen, and you've got to be 18 years and older to be able to participate. Those are the two critical constitutional requirements for participation. Anything else is extraneous. Whether you are male or female, it's irrelevant to the constitutional consideration. You participate because you are a citizen, and you participate because you are 18 years and older. So the current formulation of Section 16.5 addresses those constitutional qualifications. And every party will be able to ascertain whether the people placed on the roll qualify constitutionally. And so we're not only addressing the minimality principle, we are also providing sufficient information to check the constitutional qualifications of persons placed on the voter's roll. Now, what are the exceptional circumstances? If you allege that fraud and you say based on this trend in this ward or in this VD and so on, that is an exceptional circumstance that requires investigation. So the CEO will enable you by disclosing the full ID number in those circumstances for an investigation to get underway. But we cannot provide everybody's complete ID number because there will be an aberration in one ward somewhere in the country. That cannot be. But where in instances of fraud or prima facie allegations of fraud and so on, they may give rise to exceptional circumstances requiring the disclosure of a complete voter's roll. So Chair, I think that's very important that we are clear about why we having section 16.5 to check the constitutional qualifications and also to address the principles of minimality in POPIA to which we must subscribe. Second issue. Relates to whether we can guarantee that a person who asks a voter's roll in terms of the current, the proposed dispensation, that that person would not commit malfeasance. We can't guarantee that everybody will come with altruistic intentions. We hope they will, everybody that comes will, but which is why we have then to build these other safeguards, such as not giving the whole ID number, because we're not sure that in every single case, the person who comes and makes a request in terms of Section 2 will make use of the voter's roll according to the intentions of the Act. So to reduce the risk to the voters and citizens, you reduct certain elements. Now, Honorable Mugwini asked whether we're going to give out the address. The Concord has spoken on that matter. It's a matter that I think is settled law now in South Africa that a voter's roll with addresses must be provided to political contestants. And there are twin purposes related to that. The first purpose is for them to monitor the accuracy of the voters' roll, and secondly, to assist them in campaigning. So there's a decision of the Concord on that issue, and we have no option but to abide thereto. Payment of prescribed fees. It's a matter that we will look at in terms of the regulations where we prescribe prices and so on. We will need to consider creating a dispensation for those that may have a legitimate need for the voter's roll without having the resources. So that we will deal with in the regulations. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Through you, let me just check if any of my colleagues have anything to add. Commissioner?
Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair, please.
Thanks, Chairperson of the Commission, and greetings to the Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee and members, as well as the Minister and Deputy Minister. I just wanted to pick up one other issue that had been raised in relation to the possibility of many of having duplicate Saima Mabolo's IDs and the issue that was raised by the Honourable Member Ruiz. The reality is that the system, from an electronic point of view, from an IT point of view, has an ID as a unique number. And that is something that all of the political parties have the possibility to verify when they do the audit of the IT system. You cannot have a duplicate ID. So I think that if there were going to be a need to be sure of such an issue, there are different ways to deal with it that allow the possibility for a level of privacy to be still maintained in the interests of protecting people's privacy, but also protecting people from the possibility of scams and people having stolen identities to the extent that we are able. So I just wanted to appeal through you, Chairperson, that committee members understand that it's a terrain that we're all navigating as a world, let alone as a country, how to make sure that we are able to do the things that are necessary, but in the process of doing that, to reduce risks of things like identity theft, which is becoming a very, very big problem, not just elsewhere, but in our country as well. So that was just the addition to say we shouldn't forget other measures that all the political parties have in order to make sure that the voter's role has got integrity. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Mepe. Through you, Chairperson, Commissioner Mepe.
Thank you, Chairperson, and greetings to the Chair of this session, the Minister, the Deputy Minister, to members and to colleagues. I think there might be an apprehension in relation to the provisions of Section 16.2 and Section 16.5. These provisions might be placed on the basis that that provision applies to parties, to persons, to, you know, the media and everybody. And I want to put that to allay that fear. As it is already, the voter's roll with addresses ahead of an election is provided to parties consistently since the Constitutional Court decision in 2014. It is. And it is provided so that political parties are able for themselves to do what Section 16.2 does. What that section seeks to do is to address all other institutions or persons that it had not addressed before. We do not believe that in its current wording, that section would be a hindrance. In fact, when it was raised from an investigative media house, the wording has met their expectation. We do not foresee that being a problem or a hindrance. And I wanted to assure members of the committee, and particularly Honorable Ross, that that matter has in fact been looked into. Political parties, individuals will not be affected by this. We are already providing that voter's roll, as we have been instructed by the court. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, thank you very much for your indulgence. I think that covers the responses of the IEC to all the questions and the issues of clarity that were made by the honorable members. But also, I would like to echo that we thank and appreciate the support as well that has been expressed by the fellow members. And once again, reiterate that this has to be processed and completed in time for us to proceed with the upcoming election. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you, honorable members.
Thank you very much,
Chair.
Yes.
I would like to do a follow-up, or I'm having a concern. Can I raise a concern?
What is the concern?
The concern is that my question is not answered.
Okay, what is the question that is not answered?
Yeah, because
it's not a concern. Just say your question is not answered. It's not a concern.
Yeah.
Can you summarize your question again, and then it will be answered.
I said, I know. The IEC led by Cyprus, I understand fully the constitutional requirements. It's not new. I'm very well versed on that. The addresses must be supplied. I've read that. It's very simple and it's obvious. I know that.
Your question.
Now, what I asked was to say, okay, the political parties were given these voters wrong. Now there are other interested members. Like as you said, my other friend there, that the investigative house. I said to them, or whoever wants that voter's role for research purposes or whatever, I asked the question, how will the IEC ensure that that information is used for that purpose? What tools are they going to use to make sure that my information is not going to be used by these other houses, other individuals besides the political parties to conduct rogue activities with my information? That is what I've actually asked. And then I said number two, Chairperson, what discretion, like what is it going to, because that you see, I think it says it's going to be the discretion of the chief electoral officer in terms of, you know, giving that information, because I would not like my information to be given to other people who are not contesting elections, you know, because I mean, investigative journalists and other people might be doing for research purposes or whatever. And then what criterion, what will make him determine, what systems is he going to use to say, okay, I can give information to this one, I cannot give to this one, and all of that. But how is he going to make sure that that information is done properly, is up, you know, they are going to make sure that they do oversight and make sure that my information is not jeopardized. That was the question. I know people must be given addresses. That thing is obvious. I read that thing. But how ICE is going to make sure that my information is not misused? Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Chairperson Mashinini?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Mamabulo will respond.
I thought that the major part of the question was in fact answered, because I said that the issue of exceptional circumstance might relate to instances where there is prima facie evidence of wrongdoing, or in instances where there's prima facie evidence of irregularities in the voter's roll. For instance, if you come and say, in this voting district, there's a trend of persons who are being registered on the same address, 20, 30, 40 people on the same address. And that does not seem to accord with normal residency patterns in a particular voting district, would want to look at this situation more closely. That may be an exceptional instance requiring the disclosure of the full ID. Now, we cannot define
all instances where exceptional circumstances will arise, because those are going to be context specific and circumstances are going to differ from case to case. You know, Shibura has already spoken about where a situation where persons share the same surname, names, and born on the same day. Again, in those kind of instances, it may call for a full disclosure of the ID upon a motivation that is submitted, outlining the factors that are giving rise to the need for the full disclosure to be given. And I repeat, the issue of an address is now part of law. We have to disclose the address. It's a matter upon which we do not have a choice. It's a decision of the Constitutional Court. Now, I further said, Chair, that as we sit here today, I cannot be sure that in every single case where a request is made, that there won't be any malfeasance. I can't give that guarantee sitting here. But an application will have to be considered on the facts that are placed before the Commission. And those facts must be analyzed for compliance to the provisions of Section 16.2. And if the motivation meets the standard established in Section 16.2, the Commission will have no choice but to provide the voter's roll. Now, and in a situation where it comes to light that the voter's roll is being used in a manner, or rather the details obtained in terms of 16.2 have been used in a manner other than for which they are intended, then we will have to pursue criminal procedures against the affected person. But Chair, we can't be sure, absolutely sure, that in every single case, people will come with altruistic intentions. We hope it will be so, but we can't guarantee that. But we'll have to assess an application on the facts that are placed before us. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mabula. Chairperson, as the matter of emphasis to the honourable member, I think what the import of what we are saying is the Commission is that the laws, the electoral laws, are designed with a law-abiding citizen, and we have to presume that everyone will abide by the laws that are provided. But in the event it comes to our attention that the law has been breached, then the provisions are there to say action can be taken. And as the provisions are saying, they are not about guaranteeing that everybody will actually be law-abiding. So that's really the simplicity of what we are putting on the table, is that these laws are for a law-abiding citizen. If a person is not abiding, then what you call the laws will kick in about the breaches that have been undertaken. But the entitlement is that all parties are
countries, including those that might want to use this for research purposes. They are still citizens. And so we take that what they would have motivated, because the mechanism is that they would submit a motivation why they need that information. If they are lying, we cannot prove immediately that they are lying, but if it comes to their attention, those were lies, then they are not abiding by the laws of the country. So I think that's really where, and there can never be, anyway, a mechanism to say that people will abide by the law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to, we're adopting the... I'll come to you. I want to tell you what we're going to adopt this amendment, and because I want Eddie to prepare the C and the D list for Friday, and allow the parties to go and consult their caucuses on whatever. But we're adopting this, and we're going to further deal with it the any matter on Friday. I'm going to give you just 1 minute, Rose, and then Minister, I'll give you also 1 minute just to hear, but you must prepare the C and the D list for further deliberation and adoption of the report on Friday. Rose?
Thank you, Chair. I just think, you know, our point and was perhaps misunderstood, and we need to understand that subsection 5, we're not talking about everybody. We're not talking about the public. We're talking about political parties and independent candidates.
Yes.
Even if you look at Section 4, Section 3, so that the Act or the Bill has seen that political parties and independent candidates are a specific special case that needs this information for a specific reason. So we're not talking about making it public. The problem is that you set yourself up by passing it in this way, that you have Popier Act, which says we have... you know, you shouldn't put people in a position where there's unnecessary impediments. So I gave one example of a duplicate ID. There could be many other examples. And if we pass it in this format, somebody could come back and litigate at some stage. And that could call it an election into question. If that litigation takes 2 years, you've done the election, then you come back and then they say, but yeah, we were unfairly denied our opportunity to have oversight. So we have Section 4, which says if the parties misuse this information, that we can sanction them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Minister. No, Chair, I thought, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, for allowing me in. I thought it's my duty to clarify certain things, because when you listen to Honorable Chagu and Honorable Ruos, you understand why we must strike a very clear balance in passing these laws, because Honorable Chagu is worried about the safety of people in terms of giving of their information. Honorable Ruos is worried that we are hiding information unnecessarily. Let me state, a Chairperson, that the reason that we are here debating these issues is to have free, fair, and legitimate election, to make sure that the right people and in the right place have been allowed to vote. That's all that we are interested in, and that's all that political parties are interested in. Now, let me answer Honorable Chagu. He has already been given a lot of answers, but I must state that his fears, as far as I'm concerned, is mostly about the address, where I stay. I don't like anybody just to know where I stay. Unfortunately, that one is beyond our control. The Constitutional Court has already made the ruling. The area where we can safeguard our identities is on the ID, and that's why we are talking about redacting. Now, Honorable Rose is worried about that. Let me explain this way, Chairperson. The ID has got 13 digits. They are not random digits. They speak a language. The first 6 digits is the date of birth. And that's the one which will show whether this person is eligible to vote in terms of age. The last 3 digits is your nationality, showing whether you are a South African, in which case your number will be 08 something, or whether you are a refugee, in which case it will be 266,
or whether you are a permanent resident who is still a citizen of another country, in which it will be 18-something or 19-something. Those are the ones that are redacted. The middle digits are the ones that are dangerous for fraud, showing your agenda and three other digits. Now, Mr. Rose is talking about duplicate IDs. We deal with that every day in Home Affairs. All we have to do is to take fingerprints. But what is the probability of having so many duplicate IDs on the voter's roll? We'll take fingerprints and the problem is solved. The second thing about 6-5 Mamabolos. What is the probability of 6-5 Mamabolos staying in the same village, staying in the same house, born on the same day, all female or all male? All those probabilities are very lean and we can easily resolve that. So in the final analysis, we may finally not even issue digit number 8, 9, 10. That is the one that is dangerous for fraud, to marry you off, to get into your contracts, to get into your bank accounts and all that. So there is a very clear balance. Everything that Mr. Lewis has asked, it can easily be resolved through this redacting, if anybody inquires. So I'm quite satisfied that every question has been answered here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We are going to discuss this matter on the report on Friday. And I'm requesting people to, members to go and consult. Eddie, can you prepare the C and the D list for the purposes of Friday meeting? And thank you very much, Minister. Thank you very much, Chair of ICNO team. We are going to go to the next item. And on statelessness and the lawyers from human rights.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Honorable Members.
You are released.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next item, can you beam the two presentations, Eddie?
Chairperson?
Yes.
Yeah, they will beam the presentation, but you remember I indicated that Mr. Zulu will be making the opening remarks. If you can do that,
while yes, fine. I'm giving over to Mr. Zulu to introduce himself, and the other, they must introduce themselves and do the presentation. Mr. Zulu, your floor is yours.
Yes, sir. I'm just trying to sort myself here. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Good morning, Minister. Good morning, Portfolio Committee members. I am very happy to be appearing before you again on this issue of statelessness. It's really a pleasure for UNHCR to be so honored. I'm joined by my team, but in the interest of time, I think maybe it might take too long. And also I have an engagement on the hour at 11. But they will continue in the meeting in case there are any questions if I have to leave. I have some talking points that have been prepared. Which are supposed to provide some key information to the Portfolio Committee on the issue of statelessness or the risk of statelessness in the Republic of South Africa. I think the most important point for us to know is that sometimes stateless persons or those who are at risk of statelessness invisible to the legal provision in Article 1 of the 1954 Convention on the stateless of stateless persons to actually understand who these people might be. It will be a person who is not considered as a national by any state under the operation of its laws, or someone who might be from a de facto point of view in this situation, i.e. somebody who cannot readily produce a birth certificate, or someone who cannot readily produce an identity card that links them to a particular country. So the consequence of this is that persons who are faced with this problem face a life of exclusion from the time that they are born to the time that they die and they are buried. Persons who are not accepted as nationals of any country are often unable to exercise basic rights, including civil and political rights, such as the right to vote, such as freedom of movement, freedom from arbitrary detention, and of course, the ability to exercise a range of socioeconomic rights, such as education, employment, social welfare, housing, and healthcare. They really live on the fringes of society, and this is why the international community has decided to eliminate this scourge from the world, ending from 2014 to 2024. There is the I Belong campaign that is in place, whose sole objective is to eliminate the issue of statelessness from the world. So it was 10 years when it was initiated. Now we are in 2021. We have 4 years left to meet this ambitious task that was set to us by the General Assembly, of which, of course, South Africa, being a member of the United Nations, was part and parcel of the adoption of the General Assembly resolution that kicked off the I Belong campaign. So sometimes we should also underline the point that the risk of statelessness, or statelessness itself, persists for many generations. If your parents didn't have link to the state, clearly outlined through a birth certificate or an ID card, then they are unable to pass on the nationality that they believe that they have. So they will pass on the risk or the state of being statelessness to children down the line, unless the state takes deliberate action, as has been taken here in South Africa through the Citizenship Act, that providing a safety net for children at risk of statelessness as long as their birth is registered. So we go back to the point that your parents may be stateless, but if you are born in South Africa and you are properly registered, the Act allows you to actually eliminate that state of affairs. But if you are not registered, which is also one of the problems that we have here in South Africa of birth registration, you may have difficulties in addressing this problem in terms of the Act. Stateless persons may also be unable to access services for fear that their exposed legal status or lack thereof may put them at risk of detention or deportation. In South Africa, I understand stateless persons do not have access to essential services like healthcare and live in overcrowded areas, which hampers adherence to public health protocols such as self-isolation and physical distancing, compounding the risk of the COVID-19 outbreak that's been observed during this pandemic period. But also, without citizenship, many stateless persons do not have access or are not included in essential health and social protection services and social safety nets, and are left extremely vulnerable in this challenging time. So what is the situation of stateless people in South Africa today? In South Africa, statelessness is often a result of children not being registered at birth. I must underline that here it's the risk of statelessness, because if this is remedied, then there is no problem. Although the vast majority of children born in South Africa are registered at birth, there are still thousands of children born every year who are at risk of statelessness. Without a birth certificate, a child is at risk of being stateless, which means no country will recognize the child as its citizen. Often, children are excluded from also accessing their fundamental rights and opportunities. Furthermore, specific groups may be at risk of statelessness due to their unresolved legal status. In South Africa, a particular concern is noted for former refugees from Angola who remain in South Africa when the South African government, UNHCR, and the government of Angola officially ceased their refugee status in 2013. Many Angolans had initially fled to South Africa in the late 1990s and early 2000s, making them some of the first refugees in the post-apartheid era. Between May and August 2013, the South African government seized the refugee status of Angolans in accordance with international law. And these refugees, of course, had been recognized as refugees here in South Africa. At the time of the cessation, many Angolans had been living in South Africa for an average of 18 years or more, and were deeply integrated into South African society. So this is an issue that remains, because also they are required to have certain documents if they wish to continue having Angolan citizenship and residency here in South Africa. They have to acquire certain documents which are not readily available, but that's an issue on the
board. Mr. Zulu.
Yes, sir.
I think I'm being misled here, because they told me we are opening a meeting. Somebody is going to do a presentation. So I now, it's a long presentation, and the time allocated for you was also 10 minutes. And now.
Okay, if I have 5 more minutes, I can finish.
5 more minutes we don't have. We have 2.5 more minutes I can give you.
Okay, thank you, sir. I will do that. Maybe I will just highlight the points I think that we need to focus on as we go on ahead. So thank you very much, Chairperson. So I understand that what we need to really focus on at the moment in South Africa is the accession to the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons, and the 1961 Convention on the Reduction of Statelessness to ensure that we have the legal basis to move forward with the agenda of eliminating statelessness or the risk thereof. I think already a lot of work has been done by the Department of Home Affairs, which has a focal person, national focal person on statelessness. And also the government has made concrete pledges to at the 2019 Global Refugee Forum and the high level segment on statelessness, in which it underlined the need to strengthen civil registration and related documentation for South African nationals and others living in South Africa. And UNHCR has got a concrete suggestion to make is that we could support for foreign nationals in the country to obtain birth certificates either through the civil registration here or through their embassies to ensure that they retain a link with their country of origin. And this actually relates to people from Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Angola in particular because of the historic situation. So I'll stop here. Chain recognition of the time limitations that you have pointed out. Thank you. Back to you, sir.
Can you
introduce. Can you tell the members who are you and what is your role, where you work?
Oh, okay. Thank you very much, sir. My name is Leonard Zulu. I'm the UNHCR representative here in South Africa.
Okay, thank you. Then are we taking the next presentation, Eddie?
Chairperson, the next presentation will be Lawyers for Human Rights, so they are together.
Okay, Tandega.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Just introduce yourself, Tandega, where you come from and so on, then proceed to the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to you. Greetings to the Deputy Chair, the honourable members of the Portfolio Committee, the Honourable Minister, and the Director General of Home Affairs. My name is Tandega Chauke. I'm the head of the Statelessness Project at Lawyers for Human Rights. I'm here with my colleagues, Robin Lenehan, who is an attorney in the Statelessness Project, Jehofatso Motapo, who is the researcher in the Statelessness Project, and Sharona Kambaram, who is the manager of the Refugee and Migrant Rights Program. Before we go straight into our presentation, Chair, I would just like to invite Ms. Primrose Modisane. She is a client of Lawyers for Human Rights, and she has agreed to give a short account of her journey from being stateless to belonging. So I'll just hand over to Primrose to shortly give us that account.
Thank you for having me. My name is Primrose Modisane. I'm 32 years old. Okay, thank you.
What are you laughing at, Chair?
Can I proceed?
Thank you. Can you behave yourself properly? This is not a meeting of your party, a portfolio committee meeting. I'm laughing at that she's 32 years of age. Proceed.
Thank you. I am a South African because my granny is a South African. So my mom is an undocumented. Therefore, I am undocumented. I realized that I needed my matric. I needed an ID book when I had to write my matric in 2010. Sorry. So my granny and I approached Home Affairs. We went to Jimison Home Affairs for SEC, for Flores and Harrison. But then we went there until we ran out of transport money since my granny is a pensioner. And we went there until, like, we gave up. In 2015, I was advised to approach Lawyers for Human Rights. They said I must get my daughter's registered first, so then they can go to school. We approached Children's Court, and with the help of the Children's Court, my daughters got registered. I am so grateful that my kids can write matric. I was then advised to do the DNA with my granny and my mother to prove that we are related. During this time, I realized that I can't have an ID book, I can't have a bank account, and I can't walk around freely without fear of being arrested. I can't go to hospital. So we did the DNA test in March 2019, and the results were out in June 2020. In March 2020, we got the results, and we went to Harrison Home Affairs. When we got there, they said we must come back in level one. They don't do late birth registration. So they went So they said we must come or we can go to the nearest home affairs, which is Kimisin. When we went there on Wednesday to Kimisin home affairs, they said we must come back on Monday. We went on Monday and then they say the guy that we must see is not around. He's on leave. We must come back again. We must come back tomorrow, which is today. So I am going to Kimisin Home Affairs after speaking to you guys. I am a South African. Must I wait for another 10 years to get an ID book? Thank you so much for having, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for that indulgence, Chairperson. Lawyers for Human Rights is an independent human rights organization with over 40 years experience in human rights activism and public interest litigation in South Africa. In 2011, we launched our statelessness project in collaboration with the UNHCR, after noting an influx of queries related to nationality and statelessness. And since then, we have done pioneering work in South Africa and the SADC region on nationality and statelessness. In the case of Chisuse versus the Director General of Home Affairs, a 2020 Constitutional Court judgment, the Constitutional Court made the remark that citizenship is not just a legal status. It goes to the core of a person's identity, their sense of belonging in a community, and where xenophobia is a lived reality, to their security of person, deprivation of or interference with a person's citizenship affects their private life and family life, their choices as to where they can call home, start jobs, enroll in schools, and form part of a community, as well as their ability to fully participate in the political sphere and exercise freedom of movement. So citizenship is essentially the legal link that an individual has with a state. It's a fundamental human right. And this right is entrenched in Section 20 of our Constitution and Section 28 of the Constitution, which states that no one may be deprived of citizenship and everyone has the right to a name and a nationality. South Africa has not acceded to the two United Nations Conventions on Statelessness, but the right to citizenship is enshrined in a number of other international conventions that South Africa has signed and ratified. This includes the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as well as the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child. In terms of the concept of statelessness, this has been covered by Mr. Zulu. Essentially, it is an acute violation of the right to citizenship. A stateless person is a person who's a foreigner everywhere and you're a citizen nowhere. You are not recognized as a citizen in any country and you have no citizenship. In terms of consequences, Mr. Zulu has also covered the consequences of being stateless. We've also listened to the account of Ms. Primrose Modisani, who explains the devastating impact on affected persons' lives. You cannot access basic things like a bank account, enroll for an educational course, sign a lease agreement, or get married, things that we take for granted on a day-to-day basis. And in terms of causes in South Africa, the main causes of statelessness or the risk of statelessness is discrimination, is a conflict or gaps in nationality laws, is the arbitrary withdrawal of citizenship, is state cessation or inefficient civil registration systems. And just to give a better picture of how it manifests in South Africa, we will take you through some scenarios related to each cause of statelessness and related to real life people and clients that the Lawyer for Human Rights has dealt with.
We are left with
discrimination. Section 10, thank you, Chair. Section 10 of the Birth and Death Registration Act does not allow unmarried fathers to register the births of their children where the mother doesn't give consent, where the mother is undocumented, where the mother is deceased or has absconded. And that is a form of discrimination against unmarried fathers.
while South Africa has made some developments in the last years in terms of law and policy to address statelessness, there still remain four general areas of concern and that we continue to see as being problematic. In terms of access to citizenship, for example, birth registration is a prerequisite to obtaining citizenship in South Africa. But South Africa does not have universal birth registration. And so the children that go unregistered will struggle to access citizenship. Their lack of regulations for Section 2.2, which is citizenship for children who are born stateless in South Africa, and Section 4.3 of the Citizenship Act, which gives citizenship to children of migrants who are born in South Africa through naturalization. And because of that lack of regulations, it's impossible to implement those provisions. Another area is universal birth registration. There continue to be barriers to universal birth registration in South Africa. And some of these barriers are the requirements that parents must have valid documentation. This affects both citizens and non-citizens. A citizen with a blocked ID or who is undocumented themselves will struggle to document their child. A migrant with an expired permit or an irregular migrant will struggle to register the birth of their child. Other restrictive barriers to birth registration is DNA testing, which is a prohibitive cost for many people that cannot afford the 750 rand that NHLS requires for DNA testing for birth registration. The practice of ID blocking is the third issue. South Africa has an increasing number of people whose IDs are blocked without prior notice, without written reasons, without an opportunity to challenge this decision, and without compliance with the Promotion of Administration of Justice Act. There's no public standard operation procedure on the decision to block or mark an ID, and there's no transparency on how a person can resolve the issue of a blocked ID within a reasonable time period. To resolve the issue, you're required to submit substantive evidence of your citizenship before it can be unblocked. This can either take years, and for some people, unfortunately, it may be their whole lifetime trying to unblock their IDs. It can have cascading consequences for their family members. When they have children, they will struggle to register their children, and the cycle of being undocumented can continue. The last thing is the lack of a statelessness determination mechanism in South Africa. Because we don't have a dedicated mechanism to identify statelessness, it's almost impossible to measure the extent of the problem. The figures that we have from the UNHCR is that from 2019, about 4.2 million people in the world are known to be stateless. But this this figure is only from data of half the countries in the world that have reported to the UNHCR. The World Bank has estimated that almost 15 million people in South Africa are unregistered. So those are clear indications of at least the risk of statelessness, if not statelessness, in the country. Without a determination mechanism, it's impossible to know or have insight into the extent of statelessness in South Africa, and impossible then to respond to this phenomenon at the policy level or a legal level. Chairperson.
Thank you.
In conclusion, we have submitted written representation and a presentation that has recommendations. To run through those recommendations is, of course, the accession of the two United Nations Conventions on Statelessness, the development of a national action plan against statelessness in South Africa, review and amend all legislation, regulations, and policies relevant to access to citizenship and access to birth registration in line with the Constitution and South Africa's international obligation. And of course, to address the lack of legislation action in ID blocking. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. We have received the report. We do have the report. I would wish this report to be processed differently. I don't know. And in view of that fact, we are going to take the deputy minister now on the committee resolution. They must take us through. Members will deal with this report and the resolution at the same time, so that we are able to do justice on every item. So can I note the deputy minister?
No, thank you very much, Chair. I think as indicated in our last portfolio committee, we minister had requested that as a department we be given time to populate the spreadsheet that we had created with progress in terms of where we are with the resolutions of the committee. And we have done that. I will therefore ask the DG to then take us through on the key items. I'm not sure, Chair, whether you would want him to go item by item or on the key one and tries and summarizes it, but we can take you through on item by item. If there are any gaps on critical issues, I will then cut off. Thanks.
No, thanks. I think it was sent, I think members do have, for the interest of time, but you can do a helicopter view of what is there, then members will then interact with whatever they may have read last night when they received. But you can just give us a helicopter view of these resolutions. Our main interest is time frames and timelines in terms of whatever must happen. Over to you, DM.
No, thank you, Chair. Firstly, we are going to be doing some amendments in terms of the outlay of the spreadsheet. One, we will infuse color coding to make sure that those that have been concluded are marked in green. Those that still have some few work to be done marked in yellow and so on. But in the main, we are working on the most on the resolutions. For instance, on the first one, which is the I don't know what AD has done. Like on the issue of the implementation of the new immigration regulations, which are currently in progress. As you will know, the part of us taking time of amending regulations, they take a bit of time. When it comes to the issue of the funding of the PMA, we are already using some of our resources within the department to commit towards the PMA, as you will see there in terms of the update in March 2021. The issue of the GPW, I think DT will take us through it, but we are committed and we have been having plans around taking GPW to the other SADC countries. But let me just request that DG probably takes us through on the key issues. I just thought I should highlight those three at the top as issues that we are dealing with, but indicate that in terms of how it is framed, we'll be putting in our dates. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Deputy Minister. Good morning to Advocate Bongo and committee members and the colleagues from Home Affairs that have joined us. I think the Deputy Minister has indicated that this is a work in progress. We will time and again come back to the committee with this tracking tool to indicate where we are making progress and where there might be challenges. So I think we do take what you are saying, Chairperson, with regards to timelines, by when and who will be doing that. Deputy Minister has already spoken to item 1, 2, and 3. I'm not going to go through all of them. I think all that we can say, for example, on the support for GPW, we continue to be advocates and ambassadors for GPW. I think this committee might be familiar with the fact that already there are agreements with Namibia and also Eswatini to produce their passports through GPW. But at an appropriate time, we can come back to the committee and provide details around that. I think item 4, we had indicated that this relates mainly to national treasury. And then on 5, which I'm not going to go through all of them, 5, and also I think there's another one that speaks to 5. There are two colleagues that we have offered to provide support to members of the public, in particular queries that are brought by committee members or members of parliament. And they are Lering Tsitsana and Stephen Zemri, who are there in the DG's office in Cape Town. So if committee members have issues that they want to pursue on behalf of members of the public, we'll really encourage the committee to utilize those colleagues. And then six, I think this work was done. It was provided to the committee on the 26th of February. IDs that are not collected, I think we indicated the same. Both colleagues are available to assist. And then on eight, on the issue of the allegations against the acting CEO of the GPW, from our understanding is that the PEC investigation was concluded and nothing untoward was found. This report was shared, according to the minister, with the committee. However, there's a Hawks investigation that is still ongoing. As and when we do get progress reports, we will come back to the committee and brief the committee regularly. I'll skip to item number 10, an issue that Primrose Mudisani raised. I think this is worrying. It's a cause for concern, Chair, and I think it's a matter that we need to be seized with the Deputy Minister to look at how we can speed up some of these processes, in particular because it does impact on human rights for members of the public or foreign, sub-foreign nationals. And then the item 11, which is really on the OSBP, the quick update that we can provide is that in addition to what the Minister of Finance said in his budget vote, they have forwarded as a project manager. We have now registered this project with the Presidency Investment and Infrastructure Office. We are getting support from the GTEC or Government Technical Advisory Council and also the DBSA. Transaction advisors have been appointed for the project, and that's where we are with regards to that project. I'm not going to go through all the activities that are on the second page on 12 to 21. On 12, we have tested this BMCS at Lanseria or Tambo and King Shaka International. Of course, in the main, it was really just the enhancement, and DDG Mavuse has alerted me that this is now ready for production, and all the contracts are in place to for us to proceed with the system. Now, 13 speaks to some of the issues that Primrose and the chair spoke about. How are we resolving the issue of about 3,000 people whose IDs have either been blocked, in particular around Nelspruit? Chair, the update that I got is that the department has met with the consent group that brought this list of 3,000 people. And the agreement is that for the entire group, the consent groups will be providing them with the referral letters that should enable them to come to Home Affairs. And so far, out of the 3,000 people that the consent group speaks on the, on behalf of, 248 have come forth, and those cases are being investigated by the inspectorators. The former speaker was referring to Primrose that some of the cases have to be investigated through the inspectorate for DNA samples and so on and so forth. So that's where we are on item 13. On 14, we do indicate that we do prioritize mothers, in particular pregnant women and women with babies and elderly people with disabilities. And then on a campaign for collection of IDs, 15, we have indicated that we did run an ID collection campaign, which was led by the Deputy Minister in September. However, this is ongoing. We'll continue to work with the SABC community radio stations, print media, and other online social media activities to make sure that we popularize this campaign. I think on the other activities, I'll skip to 21, which is the dependency on CETA and on ICT. I think this is a matter that is within the ambit of the Minister of Communication and Digital Technology. And at some point, for sure, the committee will call both of us with the Department of Digital or Communication and Digital Technology to look at how we can expedite some of those issues. So I'm moving on from 21 straight to 22. DHA should fill vacant posts. Of the chair, 51 posts that were prioritized, 17 of them were at senior management level. Of these 17 SMS posts, we were able to fill 14. Three remain vacant. The process is ongoing to fill those. So we have been quite moved with regards to that. And the demographics are then indicated in terms of how many males and how many females have occupied those. And then 23, following the receipt of the forensic report, I think this is a matter on your agenda for Friday. We should be able to come and brief the committee in detail on the forensic report, but also on the implementation process with regards to the recommendations. As the Department of Home Affairs, we have indicated there that we have already laid charges at the Pretoria Central Police Station flowing from what the forensic report was indicating. But it's a matter that we'll come and share with the committee because it's scheduled for the 12th. With regards to UH and ABIS, I think there's an update that's been provided. I'll skip some of them and the committee will indicate which ones. On 32, SAB and T forensic report should be tabled to the committee. I think it's scheduled for the 12th. We should be able to do that. List of all contracts from the Department of Home Affairs, including the date of expiry, amount and description of each contract. List of all contracts, this is 35 from Government Printing Works. We have provided that to the committee chair, and the committee can indicate if they have indeed received that. On 36, recommendations from the oversight that was conducted by the committee in Bybridge and Libombo. We did provide a report to the committee, and we are continuing to implement some of the issues that were picked up by the committee. On the performance agreement for the acting commissioner, I think once this is concluded, we should be able to appraise the committee on where we are. I'm moving to 38. I think on 38, we did provide a consolidated report that had inputs from the security cluster and the net joints. However, if the committee still feels it needs to be briefed by the security cluster, we'll then make sure that that is done. I think 39 was done. Port Health and the Department of Home Affairs were able to provide this committee with an update on some of the challenges at the ports of entry. On 40, the minister continues to interact. It's an ongoing activity with counterparts in the SADC region, in particular those that are impacted by our border. And then on 41, I think this is a matter that's before the court today. So I wouldn't want to ventilate on that. 44, the plans for the Easter holidays should start as soon as possible. We've done that yesterday. The minister received a detailed plan, which had been approved by own EXCO with regards to the Easter deployment plan for all the ports of entry. And then on the BMA, we simply, this is item number 46, that recruitment process will start once all the prerequisite regulatory and legislative documents are in place, in particular the presidential minute. And then the committee encouraged the Minister of Home Affairs to meet with the Minister of Public Works, item 47. We've had those meetings at a DG level, in particular to look at what is known as the ramp contracts. These are the repair and maintenance of infrastructure contracts. We were informed by DPW that a lot of those had expired. They've since ensured that the contracts are in place, or where contracts are not in place, an arrangement has been made through the South African Revenue Service to utilize some of their contracts. I think 53 is a matter that I said is being ventilated in court. And then 54, on the counter-corruption unit, I think the commitment that we can make is that by April, when the House resumes, we should be able to come and provide a detailed report on the work of the counter-corruption unit of Home Affairs. So that's in brief the report. As I indicated, this is work in progress. We will improvise and show that there's a column that provides for the status of each activity. and also the timeline that the chair has requested. And I think it's a helpful tool that we can use to track all the decisions that are taken by the committee and those that we are supposed to implement. Thank you, Deputy Minister. Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members.
Deputy Minister?
Yes, Chair. I think we will then take questions from members if there are issues of spending. But just on two items that were there, we are finalizing the issue of saving the APIS project. We're anticipating that within the week, 2 weeks, we should have finalized it. And then so that we can move forward with that particular project. I know that it's been a donation for the portfolio committee. There is also the other decision that was taken on the issue of suspension of the Northwest mining exemption that was issued. The matter is in court today because we did implement the decision by suspending those particular permits that were issued. Subsequently, were then taken to court. We are now awaiting a court decision. I think immediately after this, we'll then check what is the decision with regards to that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Members, we'll start with Co-Chair Honorable Lizelle, two Honorable Likota, three Honorable Mgrin, four Honorable Ross, five Honorable Pile, and six Honorable Chaban. Honorable Koje.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the department as well as Lawyers for Human Rights and the UNHR for their presentations. Just to go back to, of course, we can't comment on all of the issues in the issue tracker that has been table to us now, but to thank our support staff for compiling it. And then just to say that when we speak, for example, about all Home Affairs officers prioritize pregnant women, mothers with babies, elderly people, etc., I paid a visit to the Belleville office yesterday, and I did not witness that in practice. What I witnessed again was mostly chaos, no social distancing, quite a lot of people in front of that office. Whereas when you go to a SASSA office, for example, there are specific chairs that are put outside for the elderly and disabled. So I think there's still some work to be done in this regard, Chairperson. I also think with regard to the BMA, that at some point we do need a specific presentation in the next term with regard to the budget, the rollout plan, as well as the current work being done by the Acting Commissioner. And then also with regard to our tracker, for example, when we speak on item 45, with regard to the illegal border crossings identified as being used by Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Ethiopian nationals, the action there listed is currently the BHA is working with law enforcement officials. But at some point, I would like us to see, of course, they did say they will be updating it, but of course, then we need to see what the outcome of that working agreement is. So, so obviously we need to be appraised of the progress in that regard and with all the other items that have been listed. Chairperson, to go back to the presentation that has been given to us by the Lawyers for Human Rights, I think broadly one would agree that all vulnerable children in South Africa, of course, needs our protection. That is very important and therefore, one welcomes the presentation that has been given to us. I would like to get an update. I'm going to ask a few clarity-seeking questions from the Department of Home Affairs with regards to the slide that speaks about the 1 million IDs blocked. I would like to get an indication, what is the current status in this regard? Do we still have 1 million IDs blocked? Is it more? Is it less? And also, if there's a frank admission, which I think the Minister has on numerous occasions admitted to, that there is a problem, quite a huge problem within the department with regards to fraudulent IDs, passports, and birth certificates, then if there's that recognition, why is the Minister or the Deputy Minister or the DG not launching a special investigation into the extent
of fraudulent IDs, passports, and other documents. And I'm asking this because the presenter for the Lawyers for Human Rights said, and, you know, often it takes, for people who have had their IDs blocked, it takes years or even a lifetime to resolve this matter. And I don't think that that can be the case. You know, one can't expect people to be sitting for the rest of their lives with an issue of an ID that's been blocked. So surely there should be a more focus on the issue of these fraudulent documents. I also want to ask with regards to the presentation, Lawyer for Human Rights said babies born to undocumented migrants qualify for citizenship in terms of the Citizenship Act, if I'm correct. But Home Affairs have told us on numerous occasions that at the birth of a baby born to an undocumented or illegal migrant, they issue them with a specific certificate, which is not a birth certificate. And essentially, this is to notify the embassy of the country of origin of the parents of the birth, thereby, in my mind, not rendering that child stateless because the other country has been notified of the birth, if I'm correct. So is it not a case that we should simply strengthen the relationship between DHA and embassies? And what is the legal status of that document that the Department of Home Affairs issues to children born to undocumented migrants? Because the DHA has also previously informed us that no child, as per a court order, can be denied schooling, access to schooling, which also then goes against what the presentation of the Lawyers for Human Rights are saying to us. Because as far as I know, no child, whether undocumented or documented, can be denied education. And then I did ask this to the Deputy Minister in our last meeting, well, the meeting that he attended last week with the Department of Social Development, whether the department has got any stats with regards to how many babies are born to undocumented and or illegal migrants each year. And I would like to know whether you can furnish me with that detail. It goes without saying, Chairperson, that if Lawyers for Human Rights are correct and that there is 15 million undocumented migrants in South Africa, that should really be giving the DG, the Minister and the Deputy Minister sleepless nights. Because I think, you know, that in my mind amounts to a crisis because it's more than a fifth of our population. And not only does it pose a safety and security risk to our nation, but it also means that millions of people are living essentially without protection, social and otherwise. And my question, therefore, to the Deputy Minister and the DG, why have you not established a task team, for example, with the Department of Labor, Education, Health and Social Development to ensure that you identify and without further delay, document undocumented migrants? I know there are issues of people not wanting to come forward, but surely it can't be that there's no plan in this regard. And then I wanted to ask the Lawyers for Human Rights, with regards to the slide speaking about unmarried fathers who cannot register their children, I think this matter, in fact, is going to be corrected in the Children's Amendment Bill that is currently before Parliament. And whether, so I would like to ask whether you've looked into this and whether you've made your submissions on this bill. And also I need clarity with regard to the issue of social workers only being able to register two babies a month. Isn't it simply a case that social workers are overloaded and overburdened and that we don't have enough social workers to perform this work? And again, will this not be addressed and corrected in the Children's Amendment Bill, whereby social development will actually bring on board specialized adoption social workers that will work with these cases? So whether you've looked into the amendments being brought to Parliament through the Children's Amendment Bill. Finally, I think the recommendation that the relationship between the Department of Home Affairs and civil society should be encouraged and strengthened. And maybe a last question, there's a slide that says abandoned babies within the borders of South Africa, of course, should be then, put into the system where they are eligible for foster care or adoption. But I wanted to know, in the case where a child is here with an undocumented migrant, and say, for example, the father or the mother passes away, would it not be better for us to try and seek to establish a connection with maybe the grandparents or the, you know, family from that child from the current from the country of origin? Is that not a possibility as well? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. I've noted a sequence. Honorable Nkota. Honorable Mkini.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine is to, I just want to ask what has been raised by member Yuzel in terms of these documentation of...
Chairperson. Honorable Nkota. Is that a point of order? We'll continue, Honorable Green.
Okay. No, I want to say that this matter is actually very serious, because when you're working on the ground, there are so many people that we've came across which were saying that they actually been undocumented. They don't even have IDs and all of that. So maybe in that 15 million, there is a truth into that. And I agree with the member, maybe the department must have a look into that so that, you know, you're able to account for each and every individual. And if they have to access jobs, or they have to access the issues of the state, you know, the social security, they can able to actually, you know, do that. And the presentation by the laws of human rights and that story of that woman, yes, indeed, that actually happens. And actually, I wanted to check with the Department of Home Affairs with these problems that have been put in, and they've been said by the Lawyers for Human Rights. I'm interested on the response from the department. How are you making it easier for the poor and the working class in particular to be able to get their documentation? Because you know that our people, they don't work here. Some of them, they are getting these grants. And to go back and forth into the Department of Home Affairs, it's actually a problem. So I'm particularly interested in terms of the response by the Department of Home Affairs on those, you know, on the submission from the human rights, the law for human rights and all of that. And I will maybe, I don't know, I had a look at the report. I don't know if this report of theirs, of the human rights, you know, laws, lawyers for human rights in South Africa, they've got a proper concise report with what they've said right now, because it's very interesting. We need to look into it and see in terms of how can we ensure that people, they actually get, you know, the documented in South Africa. Now, on the actually, I'm glad now I understand what does the statelessness mean. So I thought statelessness means anarchy. You know, there's anarchy in the country because of the refugees or the our African brothers coming into South Africa. So now I understood the issue of what is the meaning of the of the statelessness. On the matter of the resolution tracker, you know, that is a great job, DM, and the Department of Home Affairs. You must keep it up. I think you have actually read my mind, because I was going to suggest now is you put the color, you know, the coding, saying that this one is done, not done, or it's in the progress. So I'm looking forward to that. Actually, that was the main thing that I was seeing there, because some of the things you just can say that it's done. Others are in the progress. Others, they have not been done as yet, but it's an improvement now. So everything now, once it goes into the meeting and it's done, you can remove it now from the other meeting so that we can see all the other actions which have not actually been done. On the constituency-related issues, can you please get the contact details of Lereng Tsetsana and Steven Zimri, so that we are able to send all the constituency issues that we're experiencing on the ground. And I will also propose, Chairperson, that let us have also another resolution tracker for constituency issues, because you're going to submit these issues of IDs, of visas, and all the other best certificates and naturalization. You submit them to the Parliamentary Constituency Office, and you probably, it will take a year for those things to be done and completed. So I propose that let us have another resolution tracker for the parliamentary, for the constituency issues. So it's the same thing as does not have an ID because of 1, 2, 3, and 4. It gets locked in, we send all the information, and we track how far has that constituency issues have been, you know, resolved. And also on the, I think that on the other meeting we had, there was a resolution that during the investigation of these work permits that have been, suspended, we said that the suspensions must be lifted for now so that whoever was involved is able to take part. And I think there was a gentleman that, or other people that were suspended in the immigration office. So we want to maybe get to be appraised in terms of what is happening there. I think the resolution was that let no one be vetted out so that we can get a clear picture of what actually happened. I think it was supposed to be one of the captured things there. And the DM is saying that the matter, the committee has been challenged in court in terms of the decision. And can you be appraised in terms of, is there anyone that is has gone to court as well to clarify in terms of what happens, or is the Department of Home Affairs also defending the resolution of the committee, trying to, you know, to clarify in court what was the process followed that has actually came into the suspension of those permits. So I want to check on that, maybe the clarification from the Department of Home Affairs. I think the last one, Chairperson, last one, is to, I think that let us have some time, maybe call a portfolio committee meeting to really deal specifically with the operations of the Home Affairs. Maybe be appraised in terms of how does it work, why there are so long queues, what are the issues, and I've gone to the East London one. It's chaotic. There's a lot of people. No social, there's no social distancing is there. I went to the one in Johannesburg. There in Johannesburg, You've got people who claim that the some Home Affairs office and the workers who will say that the systems are not working, but especially between 11 and 12, and then they start working at about after 1. So I mean that would maybe there's the people who are taking long lunches. So I plead with the chair, maybe let us have that kind of a committee where we'll have the Home Affairs here, and maybe we see in terms of the other regions or some regional offices where we can help, and they tell us in terms of why there's a lot of inefficiencies, why people are always complaining that the Home Affairs office are not assisting them adequately and efficiently. And I'm looking forward to that meeting, because I've got in my social media page, I've got so many questions, and there's a negative sentiment about the operations of the Department of Home Affairs. We can be sitting here being elitist and talk and all these nice things, but our reputation as this committee and the department in terms of handling the efficient operations of the Home Affairs is not actually very, 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 very good. So we need to look into that and say, how can we assist? Let us identify this problem. Let us zoom into it so that we're able to assist where we can assist, Yeah, so I think those are the questions, or those are the questions or inputs that I actually have. Thank you very much.
I know you want to speak the whole day, MP.
No, no. Yeah, no.
Honorable Likwata? Honorable Ross?
Honorable Likwata is muted.
No, proceed.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'll start with the report. I certainly agree with Honorable Lazelle. I think that Border Management Authority, we need that project plan. We need to see the costings. We need to see what's going on at the border. Home Affairs is still in charge of it. So far, we're just seeing 1 or 2 years of some top officials being filled in there. We really need a comprehensive plan of how this thing is going to roll out. Secondly, I'd like to congratulate Lorraine Tsitsana. He's doing a fantastic job, really is. But I'd like to concur with the Honorable Mutini that we need to track this because Tsitsana is sending the messages on to the correct persons and they're not always responding timeously. So I'd like to concur with that recommendation. And then also with, echo what Honorable Azel was saying about the prioritizing of mothers and the elderly. And it just cannot be that it's being handled because the minister last week in questions said that there are no queue marshals. So I don't know how the department can know that there's queue management for these. It cannot be if there's no queue marshal. DG, we urgently need queue management interventions outside of our Home Affairs offices. Now, Chairperson, I'd like to congratulate you on bringing up this matter of statelessness because it should actually be a key priority. And, there are many cases like Primrose Morisani, and I'd like to thank you, Primrose, for sharing your story because these stories are just never heard. And, persons like you do not have a voice. And there are not tens, there's not hundreds. So UNICEF estimates there are 3.7 million orphans in South Africa, 3.7 million. And if you look at the matric results that just came out, so if you look at those matrics compared to who started in 2009, just under 500,000 of those learners disappeared out of the system. 500,000. So my question to Home Affairs is anybody at Home Affairs actually looking into this and looking at how many children are going into the system, how many are coming out, where are they, how many births are being registered, and what do we do about it? How do we go about tackling this problem? Because, we're in Human Rights Month and we have a constitutional right to an identity. And we're committed to end statelessness by 2024. But I'm really worried about Home Affairs' commitment to this, as we just don't hear anything about any progress against this goal. And it's really, it's South African citizens, hundreds and thousands of South African citizens and children that are being affected by this. And what kind of a life are they going to have without an ID, without a birth certificate? Now, I'm going to give you an example about Home Affairs' attitude towards this problem. And there was the case of Home Affairs versus Miriam Ali. And on the 23rd of July, I asked a parliamentary question. What is happening with the judgment here? And that judgment ordered Home Affairs to give these people their identity documents. And so the response to that was that it will come on the 15th of September. So then afterwards, I found that this had not happened. And I wrote to the minister, asked another follow-up question on this. These students are still today waiting to enroll to study. And so my question to Home Affairs is, what is going to be done to resolve this? I mean, we sit in this committee, we talk about court cases and people taking the department to court and that it's people that are being insincere. But this is another case where the court agrees with people and then Home Affairs just decides they're not going to comply with the court order. So my specific questions to Home Affairs is three. What measures are you going to put in place to help people that cannot afford DNA tests? I think this is a critical issue. People are desperately poor out there. So if a DNA test costs 1,000 rand or 1,500 rand, they cannot afford it. How are they going to get their citizenship? It's a constitutional right. And Home Affairs is responsible for proactively making sure that they access that right. And then secondly, what is the progress on birth registration at health facilities? The minister promised this in 2019. It was going to be a top priority. And we haven't heard much about how many of these health facilities now have Home Affairs officials there. Because once you're out of that system, to go and get your birth registration again, it often just doesn't happen. And maybe the parents don't do it, but it's the children that suffer at the end of the day. And finally, what measures are being used to track and deal with statelessness? I mean, do you have measurements? Do you have targets? How do you identify where the problem is and how do you solve it? And so, Chairperson, you know, my proposal to this is that this committee calls for a report on Home Affairs' plan to end statelessness. And if there is no plan, that a national action plan be drawn up as suggested by Lawyers for Human Rights. Because, you know, if we want to build an open opportunity society, we must ensure that our children have a fair start. And it's just not happening at the moment. And we as a committee are responsible for holding Home Affairs to account to make sure that they proactively help these stateless children. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Pillay.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Firstly, I must appreciate the spreadsheet on the resolution. And I must say that this goes a long way for us because we are able to now track and also evaluate the progress in terms of our resolution. I also want to appreciate the DM and the DG, when, especially DM, that he mentioned we're going to have color coding. I think that's going to help the process because we are able to then see exactly what is outstanding and what's not outstanding and where the progress is. But also timeframes are important. So I must say that, in fact, I must applaud them because then now we are able to look clearly and specifically on what it is and how long it's going to take. But I want to draw your attention to the statelessness and nationality in South Africa in particular. I think it's important where the LHR estimates that there could be at least 15 million undocumented people residing in South Africa and that 3 million are under the age of 18. And one of the questions that one would ask is what could be the reasons that undocumented people are not presenting themselves to the Department of Home Affairs for documentation? And could it be because they are illegal immigrants and they fear deportations? And one of the other questions that, or one of the things that draws my attention is on slide 8, it lists the broad reasons for the possible causes of statelessness from the South African context. What are the causes of statelessness and what measures the government could implement to resolve the statelessness in the country? And I think just one question that I have in terms of what Home Affairs can be able to address is on slide 18, the LHR alleges that the DHA continues to block identity documents of South Africans if they suspect that they are illegal immigrants. The DHA should actually explain to the committee the criteria or methodology it uses to block someone's ID if they suspect that they may become or they might be illegal immigrants. And how many IDs were blocked in the past financial year? And how many of those were blocked only to find out that the persons were legitimate South African? And thank you.
Honorable Lekota. Can you unmute? Please unmute. Honorable Lekota, can you unmute Honorable Lekota, Eddie?
Hello?
Yes, proceed, Honorable Lekota.
Chairperson, I think that there are a number of questions which we can raise in the committee, in this committee meetings, which will not receive responses simply because they fall in the budget of other departments. If you, for instance, if you raise the question of the education of children, the Department of Education, somehow we have to find a linkage with the Department of Education that they can explain to us what they are doing with these children there. That is the one issue that I'd like to mention, that we must look at our issues that we want to pick up and look to what department they are relevant and encourage this department to link up with such departments so that they can at least give us a coordinated response. Secondly, a question that I think is very important to us. This young lady, 32, they said she's 32 years old, or she said she was 32 years old. She said she went to Home Affairs with her grandmother, and because she's trying to get her citizenship. They went there and there were tests that were taken on them and so on. We didn't get a response. What did Home Affairs find? If this girl has got her grandmother in this country and she lives with her and she goes with her to the department and they get her daughters to get registered at schools and so on. What did they do with her? Why is it she still doesn't have citizenship now? Because if her blood test proved that she was the grandchild of this lady, her fingerprint, well, maybe not fingerprints, but other things, then she should, by now she should be having citizenship. We must pursue a case like that so that we are able to explain what is the problem inside the department, if it is a department, or if there's something wrong with her. Now, I think she spoke to us, she left, she still doesn't have citizenship. Her children are going to school now here. But what are we saying about her? Why is she not getting her citizenship? Now, when we tackle issues in that way, we must be able to find explanations of why these things are like this. The last point I want to raise is, I think, and please correct me, Chairperson, if I'm wrong, but I heard somebody saying something like there are 15 million people in this country that are either stateless or something like that. Is that 15 million people they're talking about? Are they part of the 57 million South Africans which are registered? If not, are they more than, they are above the 57 million that is generally counted as South Africans? I really want to have clarity on that question. Because if we have some 15 million people that are not registered but are living in this country, how many children are they having per year and all of that? How many are they now? So those are the issues that I think we must get some responses from. And I think we will begin to make progress if we tackle the issues in a systematic way. I listened to my colleagues in the committee. People raise constructive questions here. But one of us starts and talk about one issue there, the other about that one, and so on. And ultimately, we are not focused on what information we are tackling. And I'm wondering whether this thing of the virtual meetings, how much is affecting, because if we were sitting in one meeting, we could then say, look, let's leave that issue and tackle this one for starters and move as one. Right now we are moving as 15 different committees. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Coaches. Honorable Chavan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. And let me join those of my colleagues who appreciated your foresight to bring in the issue of taking off the committee resolution since we have started the sixth parliament. I think it gives an indication of work done and we're able to get in touch with the weaknesses that are at the department. I'll also appreciate progress as a result of our decision. And secondly, Chair, noting the report that it has been presented by Mr. Zulu and Ms. Chauke on their observations that they've presented to the committee.
On that score, Chair, I will propose, in fact, in line with the veteran, that because if you have read the report, in particular presented by Ms. Chauke, you realize that there are certain areas of work that has been done by Home Affairs. If you refer back to the report that Home Affairs has been presenting to the committee and grounding it to the progress that the department has made, it will be quite important, Chair, that we re-channel that report to the Home Affairs Department so that we are able to get a comprehensive report in terms of the issues that are raised and bring them back to the committee. Honorable Mqini suggests, which I think I fully agree, Chair, that within the process of this tracking down the reports, we may need to have a committee that will deal with those issues that are raised in the report. There are some of the issues which, Chair, in terms of the prescripts of the immigration and the laws, are lost in terms of how the department is functioning of Home Affairs that are emerging from the report. So it will be important, Chair, that we rechannel that those reports so that the Home Affairs come back to the committee with a comprehensive and focused point of the issues that are raising. And I'm sure, Chair, you can highlight that in the report highlights that there are babies, it has observed there are babies that are dumped in the borders of our country, if I correctly captured it well. But contrary, we have not been exposed to that, or neither any department or municipalities or provincial government closer to the area have not been exposed to the numbers that they are raising in the report. So there are certain issues that are raised, which I think we may need to give time to the department to come back. And the veteran is correct that there are issues that are interlinked with a other department, but grounding our focus on the issues that are raised. The second point, Chair, moving on to this report that has been presented, the progress report. Chair, I think I'm identifying the issue of the government printing works. And it's not in detail as the report. You remember that we went conducted an oversight at government printing works, and there were issues around that, both its operation and governance, leadership. And now, as you speak, Chair, the challenges that has emerged in terms of the collapse of its system. And the committee will need to focus and venture in that area, Chair, because it's one of the institutions that we as the committee and the Home Affairs price in terms of its progress and its revenue base. And the intention, as the DG indicates, to be an ambassador to bring more activities that will generate the revenue, but also put in platform the good work that is the government printing works. So we need to venture into the this government printing works, Chair, because if the systems are collapsing and the committee is passive in terms of interacting with oversight, we will be failing in our work. And I'm riding on the point that the veteran Lukota has raised, that we need to put areas to focus, identify key issues, but with the overall understanding that the tracking of the report lies with the oversight mechanism for us to get clear and response to that. I'm proposing, Chair, that we must engage again in an oversight to that government printing works.
channel our efforts to that area. Chair, the long queues, I think co-chair is raising it's a matter that we must also get into on the ground. In fact, because in the meeting we received a report, but in practice we must interact with these offices, Chair. When you go to the offices as we report, you find long queues, you are asked, these are the challenges with the committee, the Home Affairs has been responding to the committee. And you will agree, Chair, that the department at all times, when confronted with this issue what members are raising of long queues, they have responses that give confidence that is work that has been done. But when you go on the ground, you find a different picture on the work that has been. So I suggest that, Chair, that we must confront conduct an oversight. Just pick three or four offices in the country and conduct an oversight. So they demonstrate they demonstrate the work that they present the committee vis-a-vis the practical observation that our people are facing on the ground. The last two issues, Chair, which I want to also raise, it's a matter around which is being raised in the report of the corrupt unit, anti-corrupt unit at the Department of Home Affairs. And it's not a new matter, or that is a new institution there, unit. We said the department, they must consolidate and bring the report to the committee on the work that has been reporting to the committee, corrupt activities that their report has been highlighting to us. So the committee has a fair view on whether the department is in progress, is making progress in terms of the challenges that they're facing in order to uproot this corrupt activity. So that report is important so that you highlight it as the key area in terms of the issues that are being raised. The department is facing with major corrupt activities. You, the department, as a result of PP, public protest report, you have taken initiative to review all the payments around the activities that are done. So you give more indication beyond these issues that are raised. It's important that that report fully must come back to the committee. I fully agree, Chair, with the proposal that we need to have a committee that we can zoom on the issues that are brought before the portfolio committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I see we are left with 2 minutes to finish the meeting, but I'm sure we've conversed a lot of issues and we are agreeing about a lot of issues. But I want to give, I see Mr. Zulu has left the meeting, so I'll give the Ms. Chauke the 1 minute. Then over to you, Deputy Minister and the DG. But things that you can't respond to, you can send them in writing. Not necessarily that you need to respond to everything today. Over to you, Ms. Chauke.
I will comment on the specific items that were raised. On the issue of undocumented mothers or undocumented parents, birth registration in the context of sex does not transfer citizenship. But why birth registration is so important in the fight against statelessness is that what contains that enables a child to either claim or confirm citizenship in their country of, you know, in a country where they have entitlement to it, either by birth or because their parents come from that country. And this leaves a distinction between notification of birth and why the introduction of a notification of birth for foreign-born children
is essentially a denial of their rights is because the notification of birth is not the same as a birth certificate. And a notification of birth is not accepted by other institutions such as education, educational facilities or healthcare facilities. And this is why it's necessary to issue birth certificates to both citizens and non-citizens in South Africa so that they can then secure their right to name and a nationality. In terms of the statistics that we raised on registered people in South Africa, the number of 15 million, that number is given by the World Bank, and it's a number indicating the number of people without legal identity in South Africa. So these are people that don't hold birth certificates or identity documents, and these are not just migrants. So that number is inclusive of South African citizens and migrants. And why that number is significant is that it gives us an indication that there is a problem or lack of documentation amongst quite a significant percentage of the population in South Africa. Being undocumented is again not the same as being stateless, but it does put someone at a heightened risk of statelessness, because without legal identity, you cannot provide proof of who you are and what your citizenship is. So until we do have clear data on the number of stateless persons, the data that we have currently speaks to the numbers of people who are at least at risk of statelessness. Another example of undocumented people in South Africa is the Phakamisa case, the 2019 case dealing with the rights of undocumented learners to education. In that case, in 2019, the Department of Basic Education filed an affidavit indicating that they had over 900,000 children who were undocumented, South Africans and non-South Africans. The South Africans were actually 800,000. So it just goes to emphasize that this is a problem that spans across or affects citizens and non-citizens alike. And in the instance of the unmarried fathers, we have launched a constitutional challenge to a section of the Birth and Death Registration Act that causes that problem. But what we realize is that in practice, unmarried fathers who are South African citizens and documented continue to face difficulties in registering their children in local offices where the mother is not there, the mother has absconded, or the mother is deceased, even though he is documented.
Thank you.
And also the issue of the details. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for this opportunity once again. And we would love to have another opportunity to continue further engagements on this matter.
We will give you an opportunity to engage. We will want to deal with this matter in a more focused way as members of the have dealt with. But what you must improve on is the time. When I give you time, don't take too much time. I see Mr. Zulu is not in. There's Miss Bianca from UNHCR. Just closing remarks. 2 minutes.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson. My name is Bianca Robertson. I'm with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and I'm the statelessness focal for South Africa. So just in conclusion, I wish to express my heartfelt thank you to the members and, of course, to you, Chairperson, and just to reiterate the support of the UNHCR that we are willing to provide not just technical but also financial assistance and support to the government of South Africa, in particular the Department of Home Affairs, in the issues relating to statelessness. In particular, we are working very closely with the statelessness focal in the Department of Home Affairs to provide support on a birth registration campaign, which will take place in 2021. And I agree that we need a more focused discussion. We are available as UNHCR to have this discussion, and we also will provide the technical guidance and the report for that discussion. So thank you, Honorable Chair, and look forward to working closely with you and the members.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ms. Roberts. Sister Zandile Nzako, Mshat.
Siyabonga baba. I really would have appreciated, Chair, if we really had enough time to deal with these things in this platform so that we can just subtract some of the misconceptions that might have happened. The first issue that I would like to say is that we are very willing and we really accept the item track schedule. We believe that it gives us a good relationship with the committee so that we are held accountable, so that the work that we do actually gets recognized. And it will forever be better because issues continue to evolve as we move some of them. We appreciate, Chair, the relationship that we have with the UNHCR. And just yesterday, we were sending an agreement with them to deal with the issue of the backlog on refugees, which we had presented. And as such, we will continue to work with them. There are other questions that I think members have asked that I believe they fall into the purview of other departments, like the issue of how many babies are born in health facilities. We register beds as they come to us in health facilities, but people who have statistics of how many beds have occurred within a single period or in a year, that will be the Department of Health. We can tell you how many beds we have actually registered, and we also get to compare that with the reports that we get from Department of Health. For instance, they are the ones who were able to tell you that out of beds, 10 beds that happened today, 3 of the parents could not provide documentation because they are of foreign, they are foreign nationals or they are immigrants and so on. So their children, they are following the status of their parents. I thought it's important. Also around issues of education, I think those must go there. On the issue of statelessness, I think we must deal with it because let's not live with an impression that says stateless people is anyone in the country who does not have documentation. Or we live saying a stateless person is a person who is looking for documentation from Home Affairs or some form of recognition, and we are refusing to give that person those particular documents. Because there will be a variety of reasons. You will find that a person, which is what we deal with mostly, they require South African citizenship. When we verify, you verify that person, and then you find out that they've already been registered as a citizen of another country, for instance, our surrounding countries. And as such, sometimes we end up having to decline those people's citizenship. So I'm just citing that example. And some of them, they will then say, no, we don't have those documents. So I just want us to separate statelessness problems and problems that are associated with illegal immigration. And I'm very happy that the LHR is saying, the lawyers for whom human is saying clearly that the 15 million we're talking about are people without documentation. And we know very well that the majority of them are people who are in the country illegally. Now, how do we deal with the issue of statelessness? Our project on early birth registration, that is the first thing that we said we are prioritizing when we came in 2019, to say, if you can make sure that each and every baby that leaves the hospital is registered and gets a birth certificate, then you will be able to deal with the majority of problems that are surrounding statelessness. And that is why, as Honorable Ross was asking, we have 391 presence of Home Affairs in birth facilities. Just in the last financial year, we added 47. Our target is to have 1,445 connected health facilities by 2024. So that one is very clear. If we are able to meet those targets as we are moving very well, then we should be able that every child that is deserving of a South African citizenship, they will get their birth certificate there. The other issue that, I'll summarize. The other issue that we are doing there is that we are now in the process of changing the laws. And I think we met with the Honorable Lizelle in the other committee, where we indicated the issue of the rights of unmarried fathers, that they must be taken care of and they must be recognized so that we can be able to move on. But we still have a responsibility to set up internal control systems like the issue of testing, which will really help us a lot because we have to ascertain that the person who presents themselves as a parent, are they really a parent after a child has lasted so long? We are looking at improving the system of acquiring DNA. We are looking at having private people so that we can achieve the comparative prices and the dropping prices. The issue of the queues only lies with our ACES project, and this is why we are pushing very hard to conclude it so that we are able to deal with systematic issues there. The rest of the questions, I think, will then respond to you in writing. But I really wish that we had more time to deal with some of the issues and what we are doing.
Thank you.
Tishi,
do you want to say something?
Maybe just 2 minutes in addition. Thank you so much, Advocate Bongo. Chairperson, on the in addition to what the minister, the Deputy Minister raised, Honorable Lizelle, the issues that you have raised with regards to the Belleville office, similarly, Honorable Ross, I think those are issues that will take quite serious because we have issued regulations to all the offices in terms of how they need to ensure that there's enforcement around social distancing and all the matters related to COVID. We do take the point you're raising around strengthening partnerships. I just want to say, Chair, this report by the LHRC, we will definitely interrogate it. It warrants us to look at it because we're sitting with a different report from the South African Human Rights Commission, whom we are meeting sometime next week. They've presented us different figures, nowhere near the 15 million that is being referred to. So these are issues that we are attending to. I think with regards to Honorable Spinney, I think where you do identify poor communities, we do have deviations for those communities where we waive fees, including in areas where we do have disasters. I think the Honorable Likota made a recommendation around how we can enhance the coordination. For example, issues that the Honorable Ross is raising around the number of learners that are lost in the system. In the Western Cape alone, we do know that it was more than 114,000 last year. But there might be a mandate creep into other government departments, and therefore we'll want to present a coordinated approach at some point with regards to that. And then I think we do take other comments that have been made, the oversight visit and the presentation on the BMA, the project plan. We will be able to provide that. I have forwarded Honorable Ross Tetsana's details and will follow up on those issues that you have said are not being attended to, and we'll look into those. I think that's it, Chair. Thank you.
No, thank you very much for the all the presenters and the work done by the department. I think I must say this, that as a committee of parliament, we don't take very light the work that you do and the work you provide to the committee. I think we're going to do an oversight on GPW as soon as we get a date. As Honorable Chabane has raised sharp issues around GPW, we'll also do the long queues. We'll do oversight around the long queues. I think I was in Cape Town last week. I also saw something relating to that. And we will have a meeting amongst ourselves as members just to create focus areas, as Honorable Likota has suggested, that we need to focus on issues. The report by Ms. Chauke, unfortunately, the DM and DG were here. We are submitting this report to you. We will, on a later date, request you to comment on a further, on a more detailed on what has been raised here and the action that the department is doing with regard to the issues that have been raised by that specific report. Please also pass it to the minister. With regard to the issue that is in court, I think we had requested that you uplift the suspensions of the people related to this matter, because it will not end there in the court today. Whatever the decision is being taken there, we are still continuing to investigate. Honorable Lizelle has sent a letter to me which we're going to be looking at management, that you need to further investigate the permits. So our investigation will be hampered if some officials are not at work. If they are charged, they must be charged whilst they're at work, so that we can, as a committee, get certain information that we must get in dealing with our oversight. So we would appreciate if those officials can be brought back to work, those that are suspended. And then on other issues, I think generally we are quite satisfied with the manner in which DG, since you got into office, you stabilizing the area. We are hopeful that we will take this Home Affairs to the heights that it must go to, particularly on this issue. The issue of queues are very, very, very serious issues. And we want to appreciate, the Deputy Minister and DG, that the manner in which we have dealt with this border, the border problems that we've had, after our oversight, I think, and our suggestions, we followed them in a very, very good way and without fail. I think we do appreciate. Remember, so we're going to meet on Friday with the IEC to adopt the report. Co-chair, I want to plead with you that we have not passed an unlawful law. Everything that we've done was quite lawful. Whatever endeavor that has been brought to us now is on improvement of the work that we've done. And I think that is exactly why we have these two houses of parliament. I think for the first time I've seen it in action, where a bill is presented to the House of Parliament and to the other house. Both houses do due diligence in terms of scrutinizing what is inside the bill. And I think we've got to really appreciate this and say and applaud the SOP for having raised those issues, because in the past we'll only find the NCOP rubber stamping what the National Assembly has just brought in. But now we're seeing, in action, both houses interrogating whatever it has been brought before the House and making proper recommendation. I think we've got to really applaud that kind of work. And with those few words, I would like to thank you very much, everyone, for attending the meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, we're going to talk. Makua.